In today's episode, we wrap up our coverage of last week's Rethink Music Conference with a conversation between guest hosts Chris Babbitts and Kristen Thompson. Kristen is a community organizer, social policy researcher, entrepreneur, and musician. She's also a consultant at the Future of Music Coalition, which recently unveiled the findings from its massive Artist Revenue Streams project, designed to answer the question, how are today's musicians earning money? After interviewing more than 80 composers and performers, conducting a dozen financial case studies, and distributing an online survey to more than 5,000 musicians, the Future of Music Coalition has identified 42 distinct revenue streams, ranging from karaoke licensing to merchandise sales. Friend of the show, assistant director of Harvard Law School's Cyber Law Clinic, and lecturer at Harvard Law School, Chris asked Kristen about her research and its implications for contemporary musicians.
And welcome to Radio Berkman.
Hello, Chris.
Maybe we could start by just having you tell me a little bit about what Future of Music Coalition is and when did it start and what's sort of the mission of the organization?
Future of Music Coalition is a national nonprofit that advocates for music creators in the most general sense. It started in about 2000 when we realized there was a big shift in the landscape going on. And we were trying to address the issues at the intersection of music, law, technology, and policy. So for the past 11 or 12 years, we've been engaging in a number of policy-based issues, trying to understand what musicians' role is in the ongoing conversations.
I always love to see what you all have to say about a particular issue because the industry is, I think, focused on record labels and then publishers and the digital media companies. And in some ways, the artist community kind of doesn't always line up with one of those in particular. It overlaps. You always bring such an interesting perspective to issues. And maybe talk a little bit about how the Artist Revenue Stream Project came about.
Our Artist Revenue Streams is a multi-method, cross-genre research project. It started about in the middle of 2010. It was a sort of a natural outgrowth of this interest we've had in the changing landscape for musicians. We've been tracking what's been going on with emerging technologies and new business models with a lot of interest. And we've spent the last few years trying to dissect and translate these changes for musicians so that musicians understand what their options are and how they're paid under new circumstances, what the power dynamics are, you know, who the new players are, and all these things. But it was sort of an open question about what the impact had been on their ability to earn money. And so this was the sort of research question that we started with, you know, of all the revenue streams available to musicians, how is their earning capacity changing over time and why?
And how did you go about collecting this data? If people go to money.futuremusic.org, they can find information about what you collected. What was your sort of methodology in putting it all together?
We used three methods simultaneously, mostly because we know that the music community is large and diverse, and there's really no definition of a musician or a composer. There's no accrediting body. There's no one organization. And also, there's just such a huge variety of musicians that we thought that one method wouldn't be sufficient. One of the methods was in-person interviews, and we used a technique called snowball sampling, where we started with a list of interested candidates we wanted to talk to that represented various music styles or roles. And then as we interviewed a candidate, we would ask them for peer referrals. And we tried to complete four waves, moving beyond our sort of source person three more times to find candidates that were they considered peers. And so that was really fascinating. And we have enormous amounts of qualitative data from that. We had a question set that we tried to replicate every time. The second part was financial case studies. And this was the sort of most granular version of it. We approached various musician types and artists, very specific individuals, and we asked them if they would be interested in showing us their financial data, Quicken files and performance royalty statements and all the details, everything that comes into their bank account, and hopefully also their expenses.
Were people enthusiastic about sharing that kind of information with you?
It was the most difficult part. I mean, there's a trust factor there, but would any of us want to open up their accounting statements to people that they barely know and then have it be discussed in public? This was why we had a very strict privacy policy that we wrapped this part of the project in, where we protected the anonymity of the subjects and also removed y-axis values to try and make sure that people wouldn't guess who they were. But also, of course, it's trade-offs that you have with some of this data, but it fits into the bigger picture of our methods. We knew it was would be an important and illustrative part of the data work that was an important part, but just one part of many. So the third method was an online survey. And so this is the sort of the trying to get the broad sweep of musicians and composers. And luckily, we had lots of folks respond to the survey. About 5,300 US-based music creators finished the survey. And that was a number that we were really pleased with. We have a lot of data from that.
And so you are now sitting on this mountain of data, and I've seen you in a couple of different places here at Berkman, South by Southwest, sort of presenting little slivers of it. How are you sort of mining this, and how do you plan to sort of present what you're finding?
We try and customize what we're talking about to the audiences that we're able to talk to. So yeah, we've focused on branding, and we focused on jazz musicians for the arts presenters community, but we have more to do, and beyond the things that match various events and presentations, we do want to talk about big role things. For example, what does it look like to be a session player? What does it look like to be a composer? And then also things that are sort of environmental, like what's the impact of radio airplay? Because we have quite a bit of data about that. What's the impact of a label relationship? And how is that changing? And what's the relationship to location? Like, do music cities matter? So we have sort of meta issues that we'd like to tackle as well.
And I've seen on your website, I've seen you talk about this notion of 42 revenue streams. Is that something that came out of the project, or is that something you brainstormed on before conducting the survey?
It was actually a bit of a precursor. I remember back in about October 2009, we were just presenting at our own Future Music Policy Summit about new business models. And for some reason, I got to thinking afterwards that perhaps we should itemize all of the possible revenue streams. And it started out as a blog post on the Future Music Coalition website called The 29 Streams. And that was a pretty good start. And luckily, we have a nice advisory committee and lots of peers we can ask for advice. And, you know, we showed the list to a lot of different people. And even blog commenters and folks we'd met along the way would say, oh, don't forget about this. And what about karaoke licensing? And so the list got longer and longer. And it also got a little bit more discreet. So we actually think of sales of sound recordings, like sales at stores of music, in three different buckets, because musicians think of it this way. It's a little bit technical, but it's probably worth mentioning. You know, you could go to a store and buy a record on a CD, or you could buy that same CD digitally, or you could maybe buy it from the artist at one of their shows at a merchandise table. And musicians, even though it's the same product over and over again, musicians kind of receive the money in a different way every time. So we treat it as three different streams.
And those are in turn separate from other sort of recording related streams, I guess, like an on-demand service like Spotify or internet radio like Pandora.
Exactly. Yep. Those are different revenue streams that are available for sound recordings.
I think the sort of classic story that we're hearing in probably the last 5 or 10 years is that income streams relating to recordings are kind of diminishing, going away. Income streams that are relating to touring and maybe merchandising, but certainly touring and performance, are on the increase. Does that jive in any way with what you all have been finding?
Yeah, especially in the interviews, even though it's technically anecdotal because people are just telling us this, but there was a lot of folks in the interview phase that mentioned how much their income from sound recordings was going down, but they meant especially the income from physical recorded music sales. The things that they talk about as sort of a counterbalance to that is that they really saw a difference in iTunes music sales and also in sales of their product at the merchandise table at their own shows. And in some cases, the artist themselves is the largest vendor account of their own product, which is maybe not a change in history, but I think something that artists definitely recognize about sound recording sales.
Do you think the changing prevalence of different kinds of revenue streams favors certain types of artists, whether it's a genre, whether it's an older artist versus a younger artist? Are there, you know, does the increasing prominence of performance favor different kinds of artists?
That's a good question. We certainly, in the interviews especially, we talk to such a big range of artists. Some are very seasoned and have lots of experience and are embracing the emerging technologies very enthusiastically. And then we talk to younger artists who would prefer to just say, for example, just do compositions and not perform. That's a really conscious choice to not want to perform. So I think it varies from artist to artist. Yeah, I mean, one of the skill sets, I think people should, there's sort of some undercurrent of basic skill sets that sort of recognizing the value of your assets is important, and you should make conscious decisions about what you do with them. And that might be as, you know, signing a publishing deal has pros and cons. And I think the important part is recognizing what those pros and cons are and what you're willing to negotiate in order to improve your career or make changes to it.
Mm-hmm. One of the sets of statistics I've seen you talk about in a couple of places has to do with how artists spend their time and how they would prefer to be spending their time versus how they are spending their time. Can you talk a little bit about what you found in that area?
Yeah, I mean, we asked on the survey, if money was not an issue, how would you allocate your time? And the things that bubble up to the top are things that are very creative. I want to spend more time in the studio. I want to spend more time collaborating with others. I want to spend more time performing. And then lower on the list are the sort of administrative tasks that I'm not sure a lot of folks really enjoy. You know, accounting and fundraising, things like that, which, yeah, I guess it takes a certain type of person to really enjoy those. But it was important for us to ask that question because we spent the whole survey and most of the interview process talking about money. Well, we wanted to make sure we left space for a conversation about creativity and choice.
Well, one of the sets of data that you've put out, again, you're doing this sort of presentation by presentation based on the audience, had to do with going to music school. I saw that on the website, and it sounded like something like half the people who responded to the survey had gone to music school. What did you find out about going to music school versus not going to music school?
It's true that a lot of the survey respondents were graduates of music conservatories or music industry programs. In fact, 60% were, which was a really high number. And we looked at the data through that lens, you know, try to parse it of the conservatory or the music school graduates, how is it different? And they certainly are making more money. They make more gross income. They make more money as a musician. And I think it's interesting. We haven't parsed it to the point to know like what types of jobs they have. But I think it's fair to say that in some parts of the music landscape, it's almost a prerequisite that you are conservatory trained. And I think that probably won't change, you know, orchestral work, work in for large institutions. I think they expect that, and there's so many conservatory graduates for them to choose from, that I think that's part of the process.
It's probably an impossible question to answer because I'm sure it feeds into every question you asked. But obviously, I think so much about revenue for musicians comes back to technology. And we've seen extraordinary changes in the last, you know, 9 years since iTunes launched, and more than that for some other technologies based on technology. Can you give some just general thoughts about the role of technology for musicians today?
Early on in our interviews, this was even before we did the survey, we were recognizing that the interviewees would talk about technology as a double-edged sword, that it is an empowering, facilitating thing. And it can be not only on the sort of mechanical side, like, oh, it's so easy to get my music on iTunes, but it's also a democratizing thing. It helps them connect directly with fans. It's easy to collaborate. There's so many things that technology allows people to do, even sort of silly things like, you know, it's very easy for me to book shows in Europe now, you know, a lot of stuff that has really broken down barriers and made it possible for artists to be more self-sufficient. But the sort of flip side of that is that some artists have told us that they lose control over the distribution of their music. Sometimes it's just like, oh gosh, you know, I'm upset that video is on YouTube. It's not my best performance. But those are things that are difficult to control. It's also the other part, sort of difficult parts of technology, is that it creates a lot more work because there are all these new opportunities and you don't know which ones are worth pursuing. And if they are worth pursuing, if, say, for example, putting your music in Pandora, I mean, it's just another thing you have to do. And with all the other changes in the landscape, whether it's the strength of record label deals or the number of team members you have or the money available to do projects, these become very difficult choices for artists about just how much time you want to invest in pursuing various technological choices.
One of the areas I feel like I've seen people try and put data around music is piracy. Mm-hmm. Did any thoughts from musicians on piracy come through in the questions?
Sure. Asked? We asked all the interviews the same question, like, what are the pros of technology and what are the cons of it? And besides just sort of lack of control, people certainly said that unauthorized file sharing was something that was a disappointment or it was something that was really upsetting. And the reaction to it was sometimes kind of like shrugging shoulders, like, I don't know what to do about it besides, you know, using all the legal and licensed services they can and making sure that they're on top of their all their assets. And to people who were definitely disappointed and wishing there was a technical or a social solution to the problem of unauthorized file sharing. So, you know, this, and we also ask in the survey about the impact of technology, and we ask them about whether file sharing has impacted them. And for some, surely there's clearly a whole chunks of people that feel that has impacted their ability to make a living. But it also, there's a lot of not applicable folks in that bucket. And it's, I don't want to pose too much of an assumption on what those people are, who those people are, but there certainly are folks who took our survey for whom control over sound recordings just isn't part of their career. I mean, they might be session players or teachers for whom sound recordings is just not part of their revenue stream.
So what's next for all this data? Again, you've been kind of parsing it out through these individual presentations. You have more of those on the horizon?
Yeah, we certainly have an interest in doing more releases based on all the data we have, sort of trying to accumulate it and present it using it from all the sources simultaneously. We do hope to have a few more case studies released before June. The sort of big picture, long-term hope would be that it could be replicated because this is a benchmarking effort and it's hard for us. We, of course, on the survey, we ask people to sort of think back 5 years. How have things changed? But it's a sort of a weak proxy for really trying to measure change. And that would be best done if we did it in 5 years. So there's that hope. And then another potential for this work is that it's replicated in another territory because this is U.S. specific because of the contours of copyright law. Perhaps looking at another country's music population would be interesting. It also could be done for other art forms, for dancers or theater folks. Probably Future Music Coalition isn't the best organization to do it, but there certainly are other artistic disciplines that might be worth studying.
What is the use of a case study, a case study that shows you that an indie rock composer, performer makes X percentage of her income from live performance and Y percent from mechanical royalties and as compared with a professional orchestra player? What is the ultimate utility of that data and where do you want to see that data being used?
I think some of it is purely educational, that say for folks who are interested in entering the field, say folks who are in doing composition or performance work, it's a good snapshot of what it might be like to be a professional orchestra player. But also, you know, some of the value of doing the case studies was being able to look at income versus expenses. Sure, revenue pie is interesting to see what the breakdown is and see how many slices there are in a pie. But it's the income versus expenses side where you can see like, wow, is it really going up or is it kind of just middling because the more you play shows, the more expenses you have. So some of that stuff is difficult to report on in any other way, really. I mean, it's difficult data to get.
Well, that's great. Kristen Thompson, consultant for Future Music Coalition. Thanks so much for joining us on Radio Berkman.
Thank you for having me.
Today's episode of Radio Berkman was produced by Dan Jones with Frances Harlow at the Berkman Center for Internet and Society. Special thanks to guest host Chris Babbitts. The music used in today's show is courtesy of Yacht, who recently debuted a perfume, so make that 43 revenue streams. For more episodes and information about Radio Berkman, go to cyber.law.harvard.edu/mediaberkman. You can also follow us on Twitter and like us on Facebook.